We've got a great panel that will begin now. We have four speakers. Tom Slater will begin, followed by Andre Holm and Matthias Berndt. Stefan Kratke will go next, and then finally, Eustace Uddemark. So with no further ado, you will all sit down, and we'll begin. Thank you.
Is it on? Okay. Thank you to Neil and Margit for inviting me. It's been a highly enjoyable day, and it's really, really exciting and quite an honor to be invited to this occasion. I was delighted last night to hear Jacqueline and Bruno refer to Peter's book, Missing Marks, an absorbing personal and political account of the dissolution of the socialist state based on his observations of key events and his own experiences in that tumultuous year of 1989. Now, a friend of mine recently introduced me to some wonderful software called Adobe Photoshop, and that allowed me to dramatize the title of my presentation. So why Missing Marcuse? Well, there have been several very high-profile and influential contributions to the literature on gentrification in recent years that have ended up celebrating the process and sometimes denying displacement. And this scholarship conveniently misses the path-breaking 1980s work done by Peter on the extremely difficult displacement question. Peter's arguments, in fact, serve as a devastating critique of a litany of pro-gentrification studies, which focus very narrowly on so many aspects of this pivotal urban process through rose-tinted conceptual glasses. And they've proved policy relevant in ways that I find deeply problematic. Exhibit A, if you like, in this regard. This is the most recent piece of writing on gentrification by Chris Hamnett, the renowned urban geographer based in London, tellingly entitled The Regeneration Game. And this was published in The Guardian back in June. And I'd just like to quote something from this article, which I think sums up the content. So I quote, "Some critics of gentrification have selective or limited memories. They forget that 30 years ago, Britain's inner cities seemed to be in a long-term spiral of economic and social decline, and the middle classes were leaving in droves. The question the gentrification critics have to address is, what would they do? Would they like to turn back the clock to the urban dereliction and decay of 40 years ago, or would they accept that gentrification has positive benefits? Would they prefer the middle classes to abandon the inner cities and flee to the suburbs, as they did in the 1970s and are still doing in the US, or would they like them to return to the inner cities? They can't have it both ways." And that really sums up what this, the argument that he's making, which I think can be called into question on many levels, but the level I'd like to focus on is this issue, something that he's raising here, which James DeFilippis, in his wonderful book called Unmaking Goliath, has called the false choice. So gentrification is treated by Chris Hamnett as the only conceivable remedy for pathological urban dereliction and decay, in his words. Those in the path of urban transformation are presented with a false choice. They can either have decay on one side, or they can have gentrification on the other. For Chris Hamnett, there is no alternative. And also on the issue of displacement in London, Hamnett's argument is that the middle classes have expanded dramatically in the last 30 years in that city, and the working class has shrunk, so displacement can't be a problem. But this is a conclusion that he draws from an analysis that focuses only on the economically active population. And the economically inactive includes the disabled, the elderly, the sick, students, as well as many single parents. And so he's not actually looking at the population most vulnerable to the pressures that gentrification creates. So I think this is an argument that can be called into question on many levels. And his colleague at King's College London, Tim Butler, his most recent article on gentrification has concluded with this. In particular, gentrification needs to decouple itself from its original association with the deindustrialization of metropolitan centres and from its associations with working class displacement. And this is increasingly the feel from a lot of scholarship emerging, not just from London, but across the UK in general. But if you take a walk around some London neighbourhoods, which are, if you like, on the gentrification frontier, such as Hackney in London, which is currently, the place which is receiving most of the pressures which global capital brought about by the 2012 Olympic Games, I think you actually see a very different perspective of gentrification emerging in the neighbourhoods which are suffering this process. And this photograph, I think, captures that. But also, if you look at what's happening in some areas of London that are perhaps more famous, such as Highgate Cemetery, I think that we can conclude that London is perhaps not the best place to be making these arguments. This is in very near Karl Marx's grave, a £6 million house just sold. So this is, we have to be aware of the context in these from where these arguments come from. Okay. Moving on then, there are actually, it's not just from the UK where you see displacement refuted and denied. There's been a series of studies, and I just want to focus on three actually, which basically argue that low household mobility among the poor is conclusive evidence that displacement is not a problem, and that therefore we've all misunderstood gentrification, and it does actually bring positive benefits. The first study to do this in recent years was by the neoclassical economist Jacob Vigder in an essay that somehow wonders, does gentrification harm the poor? And here is, I guess, the kind of sound bites from this article which I want to bring to this discussion. The exit of less educated households from units in gentrifying areas occurs no more frequently and may indeed occur less frequently than in other areas. The upgrading and socioeconomic integration of revitalizing neighborhoods might make them better places to live. And then the article sort of, it's almost, the way that he writes is that he's desperate to come up with a conclusion that gentrification is this positive process. And the policy recommendation that he concludes with is that older individuals living alone should be offered state and or regional government assistance in finding and moving into a new, less expensive residence. So he's actually advocating displacement where he can't find it, which seems a very strange situation to be in. And this was backed up a few years later by Lance Freeman and Frank Bocconi's study of the displacement in New York City, published in JAPA in 2004. And they argue that between 1996 and 1999, in seven gentrifying New York City neighborhoods, lower income and lesser educated households were 19% less likely to move than those in other neighborhoods. So again, using mobility as the kind of litmus test for gentrification and whether it can be good or bad. And they suggested that the households that are not moving, they're staying put because they appreciate the improvements in public services and in retail which are taking place in the neighborhoods where gentrification is at its most intense. And the USA Today got hold of this research and massaged and manipulated it into this headline, "Gentrification, a boost for everyone." And the cautions and the caveats which did actually appear in this study by Freeman and Bracconi were ignored in the media coverage. And I think this article in the USA Today is a compelling argument for academics releasing their own press releases. And Lance Freeman's book on the subject, which takes a mixed methods approach to gentrification and studies the process in two neighborhoods, Harlem and Clinton Hill in New York. The argument that comes out of this book is, I find, profoundly troubling. He looks at the evidence on displacement and looks at the interview evidence that he's gathered from people he's spoken to in these neighborhoods, and he says that there's a strand of research in social psychology that suggests people routinely underestimate their resilience in the face of adverse life events, like the loss of a limb or a loved one. Displacement could possibly be similar in this way. So the argument here is that even if displacement does happen, the displaced will be okay. It'll be in their interests, which I find a very troubling conclusion. And then finally, the most recent study to amplify and, if you like, aggravate this body of this new evidence on displacement is a study that came out sponsored by the National Bureau of Economic Research, Who Gentrifies Low-Income Neighborhoods? And three economists found that overall, rather than dislocating non-white households, gentrification creates neighborhoods that are attractive to middle-class minority households. Furthermore, there's evidence that gentrification may even increase those incomes. Now, that's hardly a novel research finding, but then they say this, in this paper, we take advantage of confidential census data to provide the richest study of gentrification to date. And this impressed Time magazine, who produced this headline, "Gentrification Not Ousting the Poor." So these are studies which have become very high profile in the debate on gentrification and it moving beyond the scholarly debate into the public sphere. And what are the implications? Why does this matter? Well, I think Kathy Newman and Elvin Wiley sum up exactly why. The new evidence on gentrification and displacement has rapidly jumped out of the obscure scholarly cloister to influence policy debates that have been ripped out of context and used to dismiss concerns about a wide range of market-oriented urban policies. If displacement is not a problem, many are saying, then regeneration or whatever else the process is called is fine too. And it's interesting now that a lot of British scholars are picking up on these studies and trying to find ways to replicate them in neighbourhoods in Britain. So we turn here now to the work of Peter Marcuse. 5 minutes. We can actually expect low mobility in gentrifying neighbourhoods. And if the studies, which have become very high profile, had read carefully the work of Peter on this issue in the 1980s, the mid-1980s, his work on abandonment and gentrification and displacement in New York, then I hope the conclusions would have been different. Peter has a concept of exclusionary displacement, which refers to those residents who cannot access housing as it has been gentrified. And here's a quote to perhaps go into a bit more detail. When one household vacates a housing unit voluntarily and that unit is then gentrified or abandoned so that another similar household is prevented from moving in, the number of units available to the second household in that housing market is reduced. The second household, therefore, is excluded from living where it would otherwise have lived. And I think that is an incredibly powerful observation and actually one that was ahead of its time, because I think this is increasingly the case in cities where gentrification is very advanced. So the low mobility of the poor in gentrifying neighbourhoods, which is used as evidence to refute displacement and to trivialise the concerns of anti-gentrification activists who are referred to as cynics by Lance Freeman, is actually to be expected. Gentrification has removed so much affordable housing that low-income renters are simply trapped where they are. And my own work in Toronto, which I've spoken to a few people about since I've been here, people who I talked to, they were doubling up in cramped apartments in a desperate effort to remain part of a social network. Some people moved in and out of homelessness and relied increasingly on paltry shelter facilities. And some actually made the decision to leave the city entirely. And these are people that disappear off the radar of census takers, which is the data sets which these high-profile studies have relied on. And Peter has another concept called displacement pressure, which I think we'll be hearing more from in the presentation that follows from mine. So looking at Peter's work and thinking carefully and using it to, if you like, put these high-profile studies which celebrate gentrification and deny displacement in a new light, I think that the work by Chester Hartman and colleagues in the early 1980s, which I know Peter admires very much, and so do I, it really could not be more relevant as far as I'm concerned. It may need to be updated, but the political spirit which informed it, I think, is still could not be more relevant to where we are today. But the problem is that it has to contend with comments such as this, which is one of the economists of the study which Time magazine reported, who said that we're not saying that there aren't communities where displacement isn't happening, but in general, across all neighbourhoods in the urbanised parts of the US, it looks like gentrification is a pretty good thing. So, the question of alternatives. Recent scholarship on gentrification is not really, it's hardly bursting with ideas about alternatives to this urban process. And it's really characterised by policy-relevant research on how to manage gentrification, which I don't think is going to change much. It really hardly disrupts the status quo. And it's shut out concerns about housing as a question of social justice and the sorts of concerns that we heard Peter talk about last night, or attention to what property ought to be, to use Nick Blomley's phrase in his book Unsettling the City. And Peter actually wrote another study in the 1980s on the decommodification of housing. And I read this a few weeks ago and I was struck by how relevant it was to the current housing crisis where we are at the moment. And he says that needed is a program that can alter the terms of the existing debate on housing, that challenges the commodity nature of housing and its role in our economic and social system, and demonstrates how people's legitimate housing needs can be met through an alternative approach. And just to amplify something which Neil Smith was saying in the previous session, there can be little doubt that a capitalised ground rent is now on a downward spiral and there's rampant devalorisation taking place. And any talk of de-gentrification, which you tend to hear the media use, should really be stalled by the likelihood that the neighbourhoods which are being hit hardest by the foreclosures and repossessions will be the gentrifying neighbourhoods of 5 to 8 years from now. I think that's very likely. And it may be more fruitful to think about decommodification in the context of preventing the widening rent gaps from being exploited by the owners of capital. So I'd just like to leave that out there and for maybe discussion and debate. And just close with something which Peter said in 1986, which I think is in this spirit of expose, propose and politicise. The large question is not whether abandonment can be avoided, gentrification controlled, displacement eliminated, or even how these things can be done, but rather whether there is the desire to do them. That is a question that can only be answered in the political arena. Thank you.